Although I am not at all an expert in biology and biophysics, I will talk about some statistical physics problems which are motivated by biological objects, and mainly the problem of the folding and the freezing of RNA molecules. So this is a work which has been done and which is still going on with Kai Wiese and Christian Hagendorf with there too. So, so the so the plan of the talk and the motivation for this studying this problem is the following. Is there something to point? Oh, great. Okay, so I will explain what is, or at least what I understand, what is RNA and mostly messenger RNA, and what's the problem of understanding what is the secondary structure. And then I will go on on the theory. So I will present a model where RNA is approximated by planar trees. And why is the problem of the disorder induced in the sequence of RNA important for the physics of such objects? And why is what is this freezing transition? Then I will present the field theoretical model for this problem, which has been in fact introduced by Kai Wiese and Michael Lessig 1 year ago, and which has been developed by us and reformulated by us. And in particular, I show that this model of trees can be reformulated as a model of a somewhat sophisticated model of random walks. And there are tools for studying that. Then I will present, we'll go into the theoretical part, namely how to build a perturbation theory and renormalize that model. And I will show why one needs to renormalize that model. And present some higher loop calculation. And if I have time, I will just outline some ongoing work with Christian Hagendorf on the problem of RNA under tension and denaturation of RNA. So, and the motivation, of course, for that is first a series of classical papers by Bunshu and Hua about how to study and treat the problem of the secondary structure of RNA in a random approximation. Then there is this paper by Lessig and Wiese, which was published recently in a Physical Review letter. Then our, what I will present here, I shall present here, is mostly contained in a preprint, which appeared that year too. And finally, the problem of RNA under tension is motivated by some series of papers by Sakala, Mezar, and Markus Müller. Okay. So, what is RNA? So, RNA, as you know, it's linear molecules made out of four nucleotides, which are but one the same than in DNA, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and uracil, which are linked by the backbones of phosphate, like in RNA. But they are a single helix in something, not a double helix. And in particular, RNA appears, plays a lot of roles in cells, but we shall be mostly interested in what's called messenger RNA, which is used in the cell to transfer the genetic information from DNA to the factories of proteins, which are ribosomes. And it's interesting because those are quite long polymers made out of those bases, which are quite long. Their length is between 500 and 3,000 bases. So they are already quite long molecules. Biologists make a distinction between three kinds of structure in those molecules. First, there is a primary structure, which is just a sequence of bases of a given molecule. Okay. Then, in the cell or in ionic solution, There is, of course, pairing between some of those pairs, between A and U and between G and C, like in DNA. And therefore, a single strand like that would prefer to fold itself to form locally double helix, which are called stems. But of course, it's a single strand, so it has to close over itself. So it makes also loops, and it makes more complicated objects. So the basic, in fact, the basic elements for the secondary structure of RNA molecules are stem and loops. So the secondary structure is these structures, and basically it is given by the set of pairs of bases which are paired, which form pairs. And of course, then this object, which is quite an abstract object, folds itself in three-dimensional space to form what's called the tertiary structure of the RNA, but I shall not consider it here. Sorry. So, if you like some pictures, here is, for instance, the different bases in RNA and in DNA. This is a well-known double helix, and this is a single helix of RNA. And and if you like another things, here is the primary structure of RNA. You see the bases and the phosphate backbones. This primary structure folds onto itself to form a secondary structure by pairing of the GC and the AU pairs. And then this secondary structure makes a complicated tertiary structure in three-dimensional space, which is, of course, what is of the most interest for biologists. So I will stop there for biology, because that's what I know. And now I go to a problem of physics, which is given some primary structure, namely some sequence of bases, like that, what is the secondary structure of the molecules, namely, and there are, in fact, if you know, the idea is that if you know the energy of pairing, you can look at what is the most probable and less energetic configuration. Yes?
Before we do biology behind, what do they measure in experiments? Do they measure the secondary structure, or what are you going to...
There are, I think, experiments.
Is the goal later to calculate the secondary structure for...
There are some experiments, but I'm not an expert on that. Perhaps I should ask Kai. But what I know, there are a lot of programs, you know, at least people. So there are even packages you found on the web which, given a primary structure, compute what is the less energetic and the favored structures. And so you can play the compute. There are a lot of things which are available. But I think there are experiments, but in fact, I think the most precise experiments about what is the structure will be given by precisely single individual molecules manipulation. For instance, taking an RNA strand and fix some molecule at the extremity and try to unzip it like that. And you see the energy it costs to unzip some, and you reconstruct the structure for that kind of experiments. But that's... what I know. That's for those problems of very long molecules. For shorter RNA, like ribosomic RNA or transfer RNA, which are much shorter molecules, then there are all the tools of crystallography, of X-ray analysis, and which are used for protein, for studying the structure of proteins, I think are also used to study the tertiary structure of RNA. But I prefer to stop there. I hope there are no real biologists in the audience. Okay, so let us come back to this simple problem, which is that given this, for instance, this sequence of bases, what is the preferred secondary structure? And you see that that's in fact a result, I think, of a calculation which we found in some paper. And you found that the molecules would like to form a tree. So it has stems, it has stems, it has hairpins, it has some loops, internal loops, where in fact the bases would prefer not to be connected, to be paired. But it tends to form a tree, you see. And so there are no there are objects like what's called kissing hairpins, or some kind of knots like that, are very rare, in fact. And they are excluded both by energetic configuration, by the kinematics of folding, and by topological reason. For instance, it's very difficult taking an open strand to fold it and make something like that, because you have to make the bases in a very precise order in order to make a knot. Okay, so
for those reasons, RNA may approximate, you can make the approximation,
which is a very bold one, that the most probable configuration are just trees and planar trees, like that. Trees which can be drawn on a blackboard. Okay? And therefore, if you, we neglect all the effects which, in fact, for instance, give us the tertiary structure, like the interaction between in real space, in three-dimensional space, the formation of double helix, like that here, we reduce the problem to very simple statistical problems. So we are given a set of pairing energies. So if you have base pairs I and G, where I and G takes the value from 1 to 4 for the four different kinds of bases, there is a given energy for each possible pair. And the energy of such a configuration, like that, is just the sum of all the base pairs which are there. Well, this is a base, this is a base, this is not a base, because there are no hydrogen bonds between the two bases. And you take as an energy the sum of the energy of the pairs, and you want to compute, for instance, the partition function at some given room temperature by just taking the sum of all possible pairing and look at what, which pairing is the most probable and whether thermal fluctuation are important or not. So that's, we reduce that problem of biology into a problem of statistical physics. With, okay. And if you do that, there appears to be a freezing transition, and that's, I think, one of the main conclusions of the series of work by Bunshu and Wah. So assume first that you have a sequence which is homogeneous, so for instance, AU, AU. So it tends to fold itself like that in a very simple way. And any such configuration is equiprobable, because this can be linked with that, or with that, or with that. It costs as many energy. So basically, you have to sum all configurations have the same probability. So I have to sum over all possible trees that you make, can make out of your linear strand of RNA. So it's reduced to the well-known problem of branch polymer, which in fact has been solved by De Gennes in 68, in his early years. So it's a very well-known problem in statistical mechanics. So the important problem is now to treat the fact that the sequence is not homogeneous, but in general it's heterogeneous. It depends on the basis. And you can even imagine you make some sequence with the properties that you'd like. Okay. So the first approximation, which has been put forward by Bunshu and Noir, is to treat the base sequence just as a random sequence. So instead of taking a base sequence with some biological function to make some protein, you just take a random sequence of bases, A, U, C, T, A, etc. Okay? And in fact, it's not such a bad approximation, in particular for messenger RNA. If you compare real sequences and random sequences when you do numerical simulation, you find that they have some similar properties. Okay. And that's because the secondary structure of messenger RNA has no real biological function. In fact, it's just an intermediate state which is carried in the cell. Okay. Now, so the second approximation, which is quite an important approximation, is instead of considering that you have random sequences and given pair energy, to assume that in fact you have random pairing energies. Namely, you take a sequence with bases labeled by I, and you assume that the energy between the base I and the base G is just a random process, a random variable. So of course it's a very strange approximation, because you know that in general you have, well, 4 by 4 divided by 2 different kind of bases, and instead of that you consider that you have an infinite number of independent bases. So in some sense it's something which is valid if you assume that you had an infinite number of different bases instead of 4 in the real life. But for a physicist,
what
like
do you mean by strictly valid?
Well, if you assume that you have a set of bases I which are A, B, C, D up to infinity, okay, and you take a random sequence of bases, in fact, in general, any basis will be different in your sequence.
Why Gaussian?
Why
Gaussian?
Why?
I understand.
Oh, Gaussian, that's... Okay, so then that's the next approximation, which is as usual when you have a set of random variables. First, you take them Gaussian and you see whether it has some universal properties, and then you take non-Gaussian properties and you...
Okay. But the RNA is not random, isn't it?
Pardon?
The RNA has information on the chain, so how can you approximate it by a random sequence?
Well, that's what I told you. It's of course a very bad approximation if you look at the biological properties of RNA, which kind of molecule it forms. But if you are interested just at the typical configuration of an RNA molecules, when it's carried from the nucleus to the ribosomes, where proteins are made out of the information contained in the RNA, it seems that it's not such a bad approximation. So that's the problem we are considering.
In real life, this is 4 by 4 divided by 2.
2, yes.
Are there negative entries in this matrix?
Are there
negative entries in this matrix?
No. Well,
all repulsive or all attractive? Or
the energy may be negative?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't...
mean is zero in this approximation.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. I will go back later, because... If the mean energy is non-zero, in fact the mean energy is non-zero in general, and this is the mean energy and you have some distribution around the mean energy, but since you have always in general the same amount of bases in a given molecules, the mean energy won't enter in the physical properties. There will be just a factor in the energy which should be the length of the molecule squared times epsilon bar, something like that, plus something which contains the importance of disorder, which is physically relevant.
Just assuming all molecules are paired?
In this model, I assume that all molecules are paired, but of course, if all molecules are not paired, in general, there is some fixed proportion of molecules which are paired, so you can...
That's not a necessary assumption that all molecules are paired. It can be half of them paired, totally sufficient for...
Yes. Now, as long as the fluctuation of the number of unpaired molecules is not too large. And in the problem of RNA with forces, with unzipping, that's where this approximation breaks down, for instance. Okay. Okay, so let us continue. So we take a model where we take just the pair energy as random variables, and then you can perform numerical studies. And the numerical studies show that there is a freezing transition, because if the disorder is low, for instance, this force of the disorder here, or if the temperature is high, Then there is a molten phase, where the trees behave like the molecules behave like branch polymer. So you have a lot of configuration of trees with the same energy, and I will go back later on that. And then there is a glass transition, and so for a disorder large enough, or for a temperature slow enough, the molecules are in a frozen state. They don't fluctuate much. And it's better, in fact, to use this picture that I borrowed from Kai and Lacey papers. This is a typical strand of RNA, which form a tree. And in high temperature, in the molten phase, you know, here are two different configurations at two different times, for instance, of a numerical simulation. And what you see is that those configurations are quite different, but there are some frozen island, you know, here, for instance, this part of the tree, you recover it here, so it has not evolved too much, while all those parts of the configuration have changed. So there are frozen islands where the bonds, the pairs, are stuck, and the rest is fluctuating, and that's at high temperature. Now, at low temperature, that's the opposite, in fact. Between two different configurations. Pardon? Here you can view this either as dynamics or as a result of annealing. You froze your configuration and you look at two different configurations. But I don't know, that's a picture that I...
But what are the numbers around the chain?
Oh, the number is just it's a position of the base on the cell, on the chain. So this is, for instance, this is the first nucleotide, this is the second, etc. This is the fifth, this is the tenth.
Okay. What's so the color?
The color means, I think, Kai, that it means that those are precisely those pairs which are unchanged, which are unbroken by the thermal fluctuation. So you recover, for instance, those base pair here, while this base pair, in, for instance, here between 100 and 53, is broken, because here 100 this one has been broken somewhere. Okay, so those are the strong bonds which are unbroken by thermal fluctuation, and those are the weak bonds which are broken by the thermal fluctuation.
Is this like a Mike Carroll simulation, or so? What's the dynamics?
I think it's just a picture to represent.
This is an imaginary Monte Carlo.
Yeah, it's a Gedanken.
Monte Carlo computer is not great.
It's a Gedanken experiment.
The idea you have on these molecules is, I mean, the bind, the bonds are not very strong, so we will undo and reform constantly. Then you look. You compare these configurations, yeah. And typically you see that at high temperature you will find small structures which look the same, but the overall structure has changed, which we have tried to sketch here. So you see, when you take this thing and you just rotate it a little bit.
No, but the reason I'm asking is, if you kept all the bonds and you didn't break them, then it's not so obvious how you can use the configuration.
No, but you break them.
In
simulation. The simulation in a larger space where not all the bonds are satisfied at all times? No, these bonds, they have been broken in between, and then they have been back together. So these are just the black dots indicate common bonds at two different times. Mm-hmm. But this is supposed to be some typical...
I'm still not sure, if you wrote an algorithm, what would be the updating step?
I mean, it's just I have a thermodynamics, so I have some energy for the bond, and I have you can undo this. Just usual Monte Carlo.
Am I missing something? I mean, if you have like a hairpin loop like this, it's tough to pull something off the side. There's all these constraints based on the bonds that are formed, and so I'm not sure what the right elementary loops are. that will take you from analog configuration to analog configuration. You can undo the bonds. And then it's not that all bonds are always realized.
So then when you undo the bonds, you then move the position of these points in the plane, and then
what happens?
Yes. You can redonate them after that. And some bonds prefer to undo and to redo the bond than to make another bond with another base.
So you're doing
that's
the
idea.
In a larger space where, yeah. And you're only showing pictures from some subspace of the space in which you do the simulation. Is that correct?
Yes. But
you're not doing simulation.
No, but it's not.
Suppose I want to do simulation. This is doing a simulation, right?
No, this is a picture. This is not the result of a simulation. But you can look at the paper by Bunshu and Wa and by Sakala and Lazar who really did simulation, and that's okay. That's all what I can say. But this was an illustration.
I calculate the partition function for given this order, and we can do this in polynomial time. So we have tried to interpret this with a picture.
Oh, okay, so it's not Monte
Carlo. No, that's what I said. Yeah, that's what I told you.
I was running in my head. It was not a real Monte Carlo.
No, it's just an illustration. Okay.
Just to show you, typical.
So you threw away that you had four elements, isn't it? This is you're still distinguishing four elements here or not?
No.
Okay, so so what changes if you make the Gaussian distribution asymmetric? Because you have only four elements in reality, and that probably doesn't have that symmetry. So if you have a symmetry of the noise, what happens?
That I don't know. I present the result for symmetric noise, and then we can discuss what's going on. Okay. So to end the discussion about this Gedanken Monte Carlo.
There are simulations done on the four-letter alphabet, and there are simulations done on purely Gaussian noise. And for the asymptotic behavior, which he will discuss later, they don't seem to be different.
Okay. Okay, so now you see in the frozen phase that the opposite, in fact, most of the bonds stay the same, and only there are some highlands where thermal fluctuations are important because the bond energy are weak enough, and thermal highland, if you want, there are thermal fluctuation, but in all this part of the secondary structure, there are not much fluctuation because the structure is frozen. Okay, so that's the picture which is discussed in the paper by Kai and Lacy. Okay. So now let me describe what kind of field theoretical model we can be used to describe this freezing transition. Okay. First, there is a well-known diagrammatic picture which maps random trees to random walks on the half line. So because, and the idea is very simple. Okay. Here is a random tree made out of bases, and some of the bases are pairs, and some there are no pairs. And start from the origin, the first point of the first base on the chain, and count the number of bonds, of pairs, there are between this base and this base, for instance. And call this H, S, call S the base here, and call this number of base H of S, and interpret this as the height of some function, and maps as a function of S.
S is just linear along the chain.
S is just linear coordinates along the chain. So this is S equal 1, S equal 2, S equal 3, S equal 25, etc. So for each base, you map this height function H. And you obtain, of course, some function which varies and which cannot... It's a number of pairs you have to cross to go from here to. So here there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it's somewhere here. I think you are here. Here it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I think you are here. See? Okay. So you get some kind of walks as a function of some discrete time, which is the position on the chain, you get some random walks on the half line from zero to, okay, to infinity, like that. Okay, and if you consider just a random tree, namely all the possible trees are have the same probability, and you may ask, what is the probability law which describes this function? Okay, you discover that in fact this is just a random walk on the half line, and therefore that's the probability to have pairing. Take two points S and T, okay, here and here, and ask what is the probability that S pairs with T as a function of the distance between S and T, and you make the calculation. And this means that the height h of s is equal to h of t, and there are no h less than h of s and h of t in between. And you found that this decreases with the distance between s and t, like the power minus 3/2. Okay? And this is just the first return probability in time T minus S for a one-dimensional random walk, you know. So that's the probability. If you start from a point here, you make some random walks. The first time you go back here, decreases with the time, like T to the power minus 3/2. And therefore, in fact, you have mapped this model. I'm sorry. You have mapped this model of random trees into a model of a random walk on the half line. So that's the first step. Now, you can define for this model of random walks what are the observable and the scaling exponent of the models without disorder and with disorder. So the first probability I define is what's called the contact probability. It's called phi of S and T. And that's the probability that there is a pairing between S and T. Okay, yes?
Delta mean, I understand what's H.
Oh, delta is just the delta function, the delta Kronecker function. So it's a delta Kronecker function. It's so. This means that the H function of S and the H function of T are the same. So it's just a delta Kronecker function. So you may, and in fact, this will decrease with the distance with some exponent called minus rho, okay? And you can also define what's the correlation between H function, and you may ask what's the average distance, the average H between a point S. So that's basically what is the average number of bonds between the origin and the point S. So if I go back here, that's taken a given S, what's the average number of bonds, namely what's the average height of this pair. Okay, and once you do that, you discover that these scales with the distance between the origin and the point S, also with a power law with an exponent which is zeta. And this zeta, in fact, is just 1 over the fractal dimension of the tree. The fractal dimension is the tree is just that. Take two points, for instance, 0 and S on the tree, and you have a tree with a total length, L. You take two points at random on the tree, and you ask what is the physical distance d between 0 and S. Okay, so that's the geodesic distance, if you want. Geodesic distance. Okay, and you ask how does this d scales with the length, with the size of an object. And this is the definition of the fractal intrinsic dimension. Intrinsic because it refers only to the intrinsic geometry of the tree and not at all on the way it might be embedded in three-dimensional space. And it's well known that for the branch polymer, the intrinsic fractal dimension of a branch polymer is 2. Therefore, this exponent zeta is 1/2. Okay, and this 1/2 is just the wandering exponent of the random walk, in fact. And this rho for the random walk is 3/2. So those are the classical results for the model without disorder. And now you can, of course, study the model with disorder, perform numerical simulation, and look whether there is scaling for those quantities and which are the exponents. And the results of the numerical simulation is that basically rho is approximately 4/3 and zeta is approximately 2/3, which means that the fractal dimension of RNA strand with strong disorder is closer to 3/2 than 2, so it's smaller.
Okay. How does disorder enter into the model of the random walk?
Oh, it's just because you start from the model. So I will explain that later. But the simulation can be performed with that model. You make the simulation, you count. So I will see now how you can introduce disorder in the random walk model. Okay. Pardon? When? Oh, you are here. We are just looking at the large distance behavior as a Q. Okay, so that's of course then can show that as a function of t. If you consider phi of S0 and t, of course the integral has to be 1. So here you have something non-trivial, and we are interested in what's happening here, where t scales at minus. I'm sorry, that's if you don't see. Okay. So we are interested in what's happening here. Here, it's something which is non-universal and which depends on. This part is, of course, non-universal, depends on the model. And that's the scaling part of the distribution. Okay. So, starting from that model, Lessig and Wiese have constructed an abstract field theoretical model, but I won't describe it much because we shall reconstruct it in the next transparencies. Okay. So, the idea of our model is first to use something which is well known, which is in fact that the random walk on a half line is in fact can be described as a random walk of three random walks in three dimensions, namely. And in fact, that's very simple because you can realize that the first return probability of a random walk in one dimension, it scales like time to the power minus 3/2, it's also the total return probability of a random walk in three dimensions. So that the total probability that a random walk in three dimensions at some point goes back to zero. One time, two times, many times. Okay? And another way to see that is that you look at the diffusion equation on the half line with a Dirichlet boundary condition absorption at the origin, and you realize that that if you take the diffusion equation, you look at the Laplacian in three dimensions in spherical coordinates, and take just the S-wave sector, namely the sector which is independent on the angular variables, you get the same equation. Okay? And this means basically that you can redescribe this model of random walks on the half line as a model of a random walks in three dimensions, where you have S is this position, this time, which describes the position of the chain. Now, to each point, you have a position, a point in three-dimensional space. You take the action, which is just the continuum action of the random walks, namely it's the integral of the square derivative of R, that's the random walks in Brownian motion in three dimensions, and you state just that the H function is just the absolute value of the vector R. Okay, and this operator phi, the contact operator, translates into just the delta operator, which states that your random walks in three dimensions is at the same position at time u and at time nu.
Isn't it Jacobian?
No, that's Jacobian is taken into account. It's not a change of variables. It's not a change of variables. It's just a reformulation of the model into another model which has the same observable in the S sector. Okay? So there is no problem with the Jacobian.
But this one's saying that
No, here you have no... well, you'll see later. This will come back later. At that stage, I'm just considering random walks, and I say random walk on the half line is a random walk in three dimensions. Okay? Okay, so now we have to introduce the bound energy, the energy of the bounds, and of course, if the E of U and V is the energy between bond U and bond V, okay, to add the bond energy is just to add to the action a term which is proportional to the energy of U and V times this operator, this contact operator phi of U and V, which is in fact this functional of the position at R of U and R of V, and you integrate over all pairs of position. So you get a model which is very much like the Edwards model for polymers, except that you have not a constant repulsion between two points, but a random contact interaction. So it's like Edwards model of polymers, but with a random contact operation, which depends on both points. So it's a non-local randomness. Okay? But with this model, you can do a perturbative calculation, write Feynman diagrams, compute things. You can compute the free energy as a logarithm of the partition function. And now, of course, you have to average over this disorder, and it's a quenched average. And in order to do that, you just use the replica trick by taking n replicas of the random walk and taking the limit n goes to zero. Okay? So I will show you what kind of theory it gives later. So we end up with a model which is somewhat elaborated. First, we have random walks in three dimensions. Then you have n replicas. So the random walks R of S are labeled by replica index alpha. Okay. Now, we have a contact operator, phi of U and V, for each replica. So we have a contact operator, phi alpha. Okay. And now we have, as in disorder system, you have an overlap operator which tells you what is the overlap between two replicas and two random walks. And this overlap operator, which is called psi of alpha beta, is just the product, the contact operator psi alpha for replica alpha and for the replica beta. And it tells you just that this tells you that there is a bond on the replica alpha between base U and base V, and at the same time there is a bond on replica beta between the point U and the point V in the original problem. Okay? And now if you average over the disorder, you get an attraction which is between each replica, which is attractive, and which is in fact just given by this overlap operator. So we end up with an effective model where you have n replica random walks and an attractive interaction between replica given by the sum over distinct pairs of replica times the integrals over all pairs of points of this overlap operator psi alpha beta of U and V with a complete constant which is negative and which is proportional to the variance of the disorder variable of the energy. Okay? So you get something, you get a model which is like that, but in fact there is some very important but subtle point, which remember that we started from a model where we had planar trees. Okay, so if we go back to this model of random walks. If we go back to this model of random walks, you know, there might be an overlap between this. There may be an interaction between this base and this base, but there cannot be an interaction between this base and this base, okay? Because this would be an interaction between, for example, this base. I think this would be an interaction between this base and this base, which would give this base and, for instance, and this base, which would be something like an hairpin interaction. Therefore, it would be non-planar. Okay. So therefore, the constraint that the interaction must be planar is somewhat subtle, and in fact, in order to do that, you have to draw Feynman diagrams which are planar in the theory that I will describe later, and therefore one needs to introduce auxiliary fields. I won't describe that, with an additional variable number which I call capital N. Okay. And variables which depend both on the replica indices and on this additional variable, and introduce those auxiliary fields in the interaction, and take a large N limit, as has been suggested by Toft in high energy physics, and as has been used by Henri Orland and Tony Z in problems precisely of RNA folding, in order, in the large N limit, to eliminate all the Feynman diagrams of the theory, but the diagram which correspond to planar configuration of trees in the original problem. So I will show you later what it is. So there are some subtleties in constructing the theory. Okay, but if you start from this model and you do just dimensionalize this, you realize that the scaling dimension of the field R is just 1/2, and the scaling dimension of the coupling is 2 minus the dimensional space, and therefore you expect that if instead of considering the problem where the dimension is 3, you make an analytic continuation in the dimension, and you consider a dimension which is in between 2 and 3, you can do perturbative calculation and an epsilon expansion, which is quite similar to what has been done, for instance, for nonlinear or linear sigma models, or for the KPZ interface growth model before. And that was the main, the very important contribution of Lesic and Wiese, to show that this model can be studied via an epsilon expansion. Okay? And let me now represent a few of the Feynman diagrams very briefly, because I only have 20 minutes. Okay. So first, we started from a model of random trees. Okay. We described this model as a model of a chain with interaction with pairings between the points. And this model we mapped into a model of random walks in one dimension that we map into a model of random walks in 3 dimensions. So this represents just a closed polymer in 3 dimensions. Okay? And the partition function of a closed polymer, of a closed random walk without self-avoidance interaction, just grows with the length of the polymer like L to the power minus 3/2. Okay? There is some constant in front, of course, because it's growing, but that's not important. So that's why the partition function of random trees, planar trees, is equivalent to the partition function of a closed random walk or a closed polymer. Now, if we add the interaction induced by the disorder, okay, we can represent, as is done in polymer physics, the contact operator phi between point U and V for replica alpha as an L arch. Okay, and therefore the overlap operator psi of alpha beta between point U and point V for replica alpha and beta has a double arch between the replica alpha and the replica beta, and the arch are between the same points U and V between the replica alpha and beta. And it's just a graphical representation of this operator, which is a product of delta function of the position. Okay? And then you can compute the first order correction in the disorder to this partition function, which describes just random trees without disorder. And for instance, Kai and Lacy have been doing the calculation at first order. And for instance, this is the first correction due to the disorder to the partition function of a single tree. And you find, so this corresponds to this diagram. You compute these diagrams. You have a combinatorial factor which depends on the number of replica. And you get some Feynman integral, which depends on the position of the point U, V, and of the length of the tree, or of the length of the polymer. Okay, and you get some integral. Here is the integral. Yes. Okay, so you get a function which depends on the distance between the point U and the point V. And what you realize if you look at this integral is that you have short distance ultraviolet divergence when the two points U and V come together. So those are Feynman diagrams. So as usual in perturbation theory, in field theory, you get usually you get short distance divergence. And if you compute this amplitude, what you find precisely is that... Well, here is the result of this integral. You have gamma function, and in particular, you have a gamma function of 2 minus d, so you get a pole in dimension 2. Okay. So, namely at epsilon equals 0. So, this in fact is the ultraviolet divergence of the model. So, the model, in order to make sense, this continuum model has to be renormalized. Okay, so very briefly, in fact, what we have done with Kai in our paper was to formulate this model and then to make a thorough analysis of the ultraviolet divergence that I will go very quickly. Namely, what you just have to remember is that those ultraviolet divergences can be analyzed by the same theoretical tools that has been used already for polymer physics and for membrane physics, namely what's called the multilocal operator product expansion. The acronym is MOOP. And doing this analysis, which generalizes the analysis of short distance ultraviolet divergence in standard quantum field theory, one finds, in fact, that the ultraviolet divergence of the model, in fact, are just proportional to the operator psi and to the operator, the kinetic operator, which is the square of the derivative of the position. And therefore, in fact, to make the story very quick, in fact, we can show that the model is renormalizable at epsilon equals 0, namely in dimension 2. And in order to have a field theory which makes sense, you just have to introduce a counter term here proportional to this R dot square term, namely wave function renormalization, and a coupling constant renormalization proportional to the operator psi.
I have a question.
Yes?
Have you shown that it's true to all orders of perturbation theory, or only true to certain orders of loops and loop? Or
well, our argument is that it's since the MOOP should hold at all order, and we have argument for that. The model should be renormalized at all orders. And the difficult part is to see whether the planarity constraint is not destroyed by those doesn't destroy this proof of renormalizability. That kind of argument. So the subtleties are there, in fact.
But that's not yet proven, or is already
proven? I would say it's we have a theoretical physicist proof. Mathematician would say no, but you have not shown a lot of things. But that's we have a proof. We have checked that all the difficult points can be solved. Okay, and we did two loop calculation, which show that it works very well. Okay. So the result. So before going to the two loop calculation, What we have done is that we have with our formalism of this model of random walk in three dimensions, we have redone the calculation at one loop. We have found the beta function for the coupling constant, which has this form. There's an epsilon g minus some factor of g squared, which depends on the number of replica. But for n equals 0, this coefficient is positive, this coefficient is negative. Therefore, we have a beta function which is very much like the beta function of nonlinear sigma models in 2 plus epsilon dimension, or for the KPZ problem in 2 plus epsilon dimension. Namely, we have an infrared fixed point at finite value of the coupling. So it's an unstable fixed point. And when you go to the large distance physics, for small coupling, namely weak disorder, high temperature, you go to the Gaussian fixed point. Disorder is irrelevant. And for strong coupling, we go to a strong coupling fixed point that we are not yet able to study, which describes the frozen or the glass phase. Okay? And since there is a fixed point, you can deduce the value of the critical exponents. You can look at the dimension of the field. And at the first order in transition, you get a value for the correlation length exponent, for the pairing exponent, rho, and for this exponent, zeta, which is the inverse of the fractal dimension. Okay. So those results were already obtained by Lessig and Wiese, but we have recovered them in a more, I would say, proper, clean way. I hope you agree with our formalism. So what is really interesting is that we have been able to do a two-loop calculation, and that's for why should we do that? Why was it interesting? First, it was interesting to check the consistency of the formalism. And second, it was important to check the accuracy of the estimates, of the one-loop estimates, because there was nothing to compare them with. Okay. So, there are some subtleties that I won't have time to discuss, but in a few words, we had to do calculation with open polymers instead of closed one. It's technically slightly simpler. And here are the five. Okay, so this represents the partition function for a single polymer. This corresponds to the partition function at first order in perturbation theory. So here you see an interaction between two replicas. And at second order in the interaction, there are five diagrams where you might have interaction between pairs of replicas. It's two interaction, but you may also have interaction between triplets of replica, like that. And you may have interaction between four different replicas. Okay? And you see here that you have those kind of Feynman diagrams are planar. And the planarity constraint means that, for instance, this kind of diagram, like that, okay, this is a diagram, if you see what I mean. This is the diagram, you have one arch, another arch, and this arch crosses here. So this is a diagram which is non-planar. You cannot, represent it in just something like that, which is a diagram which is non-planar, while this diagram is a diagram which is planar. So this is planar, happy, and this is non-planar. Okay, so we have to get rid of them, and that's what our auxiliary fields are. Okay, so it would be quite nice if we only had to compute those five new diagrams, but that's not true. In fact, in order to compute both the renormalization for the coupling constant and for the wave function, we have to compute slightly more diagrams involving two replicas. So here are the diagrams at two loops that we have to compute. And in fact, that's not all, because we have also to compute those diagrams. So it takes some time. And here is, for instance, an example of an amplitude. Yes? Yes. Okay, so basically here you find that you have poles in epsilon, double poles, single poles, top. And the final result is that at two loops you get a coefficient. You get a coefficient for the scaling dimension of the fields. You get estimates for the critical exponent, for the contact operator, and for the coupling constant. We get some new scaling relations that I won't have time to discuss. The important result is here. Here is the estimate as a function of epsilon for the contact operator exponent, rho, and for the dimension of the overlap operator, psi. And in dotted lines are the results of the one-loop calculation of Wiese and Lessig. And the full lines represent the results of the two-loop calculation that we have done. And you see that it's quite nice, because in particular for the physically important exponent, which is the exponent associated to the contact operator, you see that the results, even at epsilon equal 1, there is a very tiny difference between the one-loop calculation and the two-loop calculation. This was not at all obvious at before we started the calculation. So we are very happy when we got that result, because it's a very strong point for the consistency of the calculation. But, and how much do you... 2 minutes? 3 minutes? Okay. So, now there is a subtle point which is discussed at length in the paper by Lessig and Kai that I won't discuss, which is from what we understand of this transition. Up to now, we have been studying what's happening at the freezing transition, and the question is, of course, the physically interesting question is not what's really happening at the freezing transition, but what are the properties of the strong disordered phase, and what are the properties of the glass phase. Okay? And there is an argument which is called locking by Lessig and Kai, which relies on the following argument, in fact. Remember this picture that I draw here, which is as a function of epsilon, d minus 2, how does the exponent for phi and the exponent for psi, the overlap operator, behaves? And you see something very interesting. You see that the rho, the dimension of phi, increases, while theta, the dimension of the overlap operator psi, decreases. But you have there is a rigorous inequality in the discrete tree model, which is that the expectation value of an operator of the operator phi, which is the contact probability, the probability that there is a pair between two bases I and j, it's necessarily larger or equal to the probability that there is a base between the pair I and G on the replica alpha and on the replica beta. Okay? Because this is a probability, and this is a conditional probability which depends on this probability. And this implies, of course, that rho has to be smaller or equal to theta. Okay. But you see here that beyond some points, which is approximately epsilon equal 0.59, this rigorous inequality breaks down. And that it means that something physical occurs there. And the interpretation, the scenario put forward by Kai and Lessig, is that beyond that point, namely, in particular, for epsilon equal 1, which is, this is the point where our model of random walks describes RNA, two replicas, there is a saturation of this inequality, namely, the probability of that there is an overlap is equal to the probability that there is a contact. Okay? So, as soon as there is formation of a pair, The probability that there is an overlap between two pairs on two replicas is of the same order of magnitude. Okay. So this means that the two replicas are locked in the same configuration. I don't know really, since I'm not a specialist of disorder systems, my impression is that you can also say that it means that there is no replica symmetry breaking and that the system has a single ground state. But that I'm not sure. So I'm sure there are specialists who could. Okay, but anyway. And in that case, this should mean, if this picture is correct, this should mean that, in fact, beyond that point, this exponent theta, in fact, is not given by this curves, but is equal to rho. Okay.
One question. Why is it not possible? Can't you exclude that the higher order corrections and higher epsilon deform the curves into two ways?
Of course.
We don't know that.
Oh, of course. Well, we can imagine, for instance, that something like that occurs. That we have this curve and for rho. And we have, in fact, something like for theta, of course. Now, I can't exclude that unless I'm able to do a third, a fourth order. But I know. And in fact, I would very much like to have a picture in terms of fixed point and renormalization group of what really it means, what's happening there. Does it mean that there are some irrelevant operator which becomes relevant? Does it mean that the fixed point disappears and some new fixed point or some becomes important? There are some dangerous irrelevant variables which comes in the game that I don't know. I would like very much to understand what's going on there, but I think we have no idea at the moment. So for the moment, let's keep with this very nice, with this appealing locking scenario. And one of the good points of this scenario is, in fact, it's consistent with the numerics. Because in that case, you expect that in the glass phase, the exponents are the same that at the transition. That's Guy and Lacy told us. And therefore, the estimates coming from this two-loop calculation is that the zeta exponent in the glass phase should be 0.64. And the numerics gives something which is called close to two-thirds, and very close to this point. So it's not clear whether this scenario is theoretically correct, but at least it gives us the numbers which are in agreement with numerical simulation, which is, of course, not a proof, but it's a hint. Okay. So I won't have time to discuss RNI under tension. And to conclude, I think that finally, I found that this problem is a very interesting example of a problem which combines field theory, disorder geometry, so that's the title of this workshop, and problems in, not really in biophysics, but in biologically inspired physics. And here is a list of, it's a very difficult problem, also it's a one-dimensional problem. There are infinite range correlation, planarity induces frustration, and therefore it's a problem which is very difficult both analytically and numerically. And here is a list of open issues. And I just made perhaps and present an apology that we have not found any way to include SLA in this problem. But that's... Thank you.